This is an Irreverent podcast. Check out irreverent.fm for shows from all our friends. Hello and welcome to Exvangelical, a show exploring the world inside and outside the evangelical subculture. I'm your host, Blake Chastain. I have another archival episode for you today featuring a October 2022 interview that I published with Becca Andrews, the author of the book No Choice, The Destruction of Roe v. Wade and the Fight to Protect a Fundamental American Right. I'm publishing this actually because I was reminded of the value of this book and of the history that it seeks to tell. After reading an article in Wired magazine that was initially published in Spanish but has been since been translated, it was published on April 3rd this week. The title of that article is "In 24 Hours, You'll Have Your Pills: American Women Are Traveling to Mexico for Abortions." And what Becca Andrews details in her book from 2022. Was the number of different groups, including various religious groups, that prior to the ratification of Roe v. Wade, helped to provide women with reproductive access to the types of treatments that they may need, regardless of their circumstances. And this is what we're living in now, this post-Roe world, which has been formed after decades of intense effort from a number of evangelicals and their allies who brought this to pass and are now endangering the lives of women who do not have access to the reproductive care that they need. So in that context, that's why I'm republishing this today. I hope that you enjoy this conversation. You can, of course, subscribe to my Substack over at postevangelicalpost.com. You can subscribe for free or upgrade to $5 a month or $50 a year. And I donate 25% of net proceeds each year to the Religious Exemption Accountability Project and White Homework. All right, let's get into it. My guest today is Becca Andrews. Becca is a journalist at Reckon News and author of the new book, No Choice: The Destruction of Roe v. Wade and the Fight to Protect a Fundamental American Right. She's been reporting on reproductive rights and justice, as well as related topics such as purity culture, for several years, and her work has also appeared in outlets such as Mother Jones, Jezebel, and Teen Vogue, among others. Becca, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you for coming on. Your book is very powerful and I think will be a great entry into sort of contributing to this conversation that we have. This show has a particular focus on white evangelicalism and personal stories, but its broader focus is really on how people change their minds, really. And the introduction to your book captures both of those things, because you start by saying how you were anti-abortion for 23 years due largely to your involvement in evangelicalism. And something eventually changed, but you start by how discussing this abstinence-only pro-life youth message at your church made the issue become thorny, in your words. And that language, that imagery really stuck with me, because when something's thorny, you know, you sort of approach it with more care or caution. So what was it about that message that made you reconsider the teachings of your church and eventually lead you to the type of work that you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's weird. Like, I know that it doesn't really fit the trope of what we encounter in evangelicalism, but I think that the point that Sunday school teacher was trying to make was that the world is a lot more complicated than we would like for it to be, and mm-hmm. certainly more complicated than it is in, you know, sitting in the halls of a church. So in that scene, he's really pressing us to define ourselves as anti-abortion under all circumstances, but to really think through why that would be, right? So in cases of rape and incest and the exceptions. And it seemed to me, and again, like, memory is not perfect and mm-hmm. mine certainly isn't, but from my recollection, it certainly felt to me like everyone else in the room was able to kind of get there, and I just wasn't. And you know, I'm not sure that's a thing that anyone else in the room could have read or like been able to tell at that time. But I just remember it really bothering me, like feeling like it was one of the first times that I'd really considered that people get pregnant against their will and what it would actually mean to have to carry a pregnancy like that to term. And I was still very young, so my understanding of pregnancy and reproduction was pretty rudimentary still. But I mean, I knew enough for it to be horrifying to me. And it just, that's the first like seed that I can remember of just kind of like, oh wait, like this doesn't feel right to me as like a moral, like ethical person. Like this doesn't fit my personal ethic. That's not the language that I had for it at the time, but it was the first sort of like major disruption, I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And so before this, you were sort of, I mean, when we're young, we don't necessarily know how to, as you mentioned, like vocalize or verbalize our own sort of feelings or opinions. But your overall environment was it largely sort of de facto evangelical? What was the sort of messaging beyond that particular lesson that contributed to this sort of, you know, it's an environment that we're both personally familiar with, but what was it like for you individually there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in a small town in rural West Tennessee here in the Bible Belt. So, you know, everyone in my life that I had ever really been exposed to identified as Christian. And obviously, like my whole family did as well, does still. And so there wasn't really anything outside of that world to me growing up. Like that just was the entire world. I didn't, you know, we talk about the rural South like it's extremely, extremely white. It's not, like, certainly not my hometown. So I think being in like a part of the South that was maybe a little more diverse than what the media likes to pretend it is, maybe did help me like understand other people's circumstances from a younger age than maybe I might have. But yeah, I mean, I think when you're like, I had these memories, I don't know about you, but I have these memories of like literally being on the playground at recess and like the kids debating about like if you can go to hell or if you're going to go to heaven if you don't go to church. Like I remember that being like a big topic of conversation. And like looking back now, I'm just like, kind of fucked up. Like we're like little and we're talking about like big existential consequences here of like whether or not you go someplace on a particular day at a particular time of day. Like
yeah. Anyway. Yeah. I'm sure I had those conversations. I don't know whether they were on a playground or not, but that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just sort of the atmosphere we were in, I guess, the environment we were in.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't remember abortion coming up a whole lot at all. Like that conversation that's in the book is the first time I can remember it coming up in a religious context.
Mm-hmm.
And really at all, like it's the first thing I have in my memory. And it was just one of those things that like you didn't talk about. So like to me, I don't even remember like when I got an awareness of abortion as a thing, but it just like was not discussed ever.
And I'm not, I certainly, I'm an elder millennial, so I'm in my late 30s, and I grew up in similar circumstances where it wasn't really discussed, but the general vibe that I picked up as a kid was that it was not really approved of, or was not.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was taboo.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of gets to language itself being a barrier to having these discussions because of how effective political messaging has been at politicizing health. And a lot of that is just anyone sort of born after the rise of the religious right. That's just sort of their lived experience. So at the outset of our conversation, in your experience as a reporter who's been covering this field for a while, what sort of framework should we have with regard to terms like the ones that people are familiar with, like pro-choice, pro-life, anti-abortion, forced birth, as well as other terms like reproductive rights, reproductive care, and reproductive justice? Because I feel like to have a really valuable conversation and to approach a book like yours, like your book does contextualize those things within the text itself. But just for the purposes of our conversation and being a sort of a sample of the type of thing that you cover in your book, what are some ways that we should try to approach some of those terms, and really what are the ones that best actually suit the realities of reproductive rights and care in the United States today?
Good question. I'm a writer and I write for the average person, right? So I'm a really big fan of just calling things what they are. So for me, you know, I'm quite happy to say the word abortion. And I think that it's important to put that in the context of the fact that I have a lot of privilege to say the word. Like, I'm a white woman who works in media and has sort of the power and the freedom to be able to say that and not feel any fear from it. I also haven't had an abortion, and that's an important thing to discuss as well. So, you know, there are people that I've spoken to who had abortions who don't like the word abortion, and like they want to say, one of the women in my book uses the word release, like a pregnancy release, and that's what feels right to her, and that's her truth and her story, and I think that that's really beautiful. I think that like when I'm talking about this stuff as a journalist, I have to like say what I mean. So abortion. And I think that also gets some of the discussion around like anti-choice or pro-life or anti-abortion, or there are a lot of, you know, particularly like older white feminists who like to say things like, oh, well, nobody's pro-abortion. And there's been this movement in reproductive justice spaces to sort of push back on that and say like, no, actually, like we are pro-abortion because we're pro having access to this healthcare, and we're anti like the stigma that makes you want to say like nobody's pro-abortion. You know, like we don't have to say like, oh, nobody's pro appendectomy. It's like, it's just like a completely different thing. So, you know, why not just sort of go all in and claim that? So there's that. Reproductive rights is a term that is a little bit more focused on abortion access in particular. So the right to abortion. Reproductive justice is a term that was coined by a group of Black women in the 90s because they felt like their needs weren't being met by feminism and by the reproductive rights movement. And that was an extremely fair assessment. So if you're just talking about abortion, then you're not talking about prenatal care or neonatal care or, you know, the right to raise children that you want in a healthy environment. So it's looking at the full spectrum, right? Reproductive justice is about saying like, yes, I have the right to abortion. I also have the right to have children on my terms. I have the right to parent them in a safe and healthy way. I have the right to my own health care and clean water and nutritious food, education, all that good stuff. So when I often am thinking about this stuff, I'm thinking about it from a reproductive justice framework, just because I think it encapsulates more and it just makes more sense in my head. Like, I don't think of abortion as something that needs to be pulled out of everything else. To me, like it's part of everyday healthcare, is part of reproductive healthcare. It's the same, it's on the same wheel as, you know, going to get birth control or, you know, STI or STD testing or cervical cancer or like whatever it is, right? So those are kind of an overview of the terms. And then the other thing that I'd like to say is that I think that we've done a disservice to, you know, or maybe our elders have done a disservice to our generation, yours and mine, by using euphemisms instead of really talking about sex, frankly, and really talking about reproduction, frankly. So I think about this a lot. When I was like coming out of evangelicalism, there I would have these conversations where like a girl who was in the college ministry that I was in would approach me and like ask me questions about sex. And it was pretty like, they were pretty like basic questions like, oh, like this is because like in those circles, which are like all encompassing, like that's your entire life, we don't talk about that. And that's disempowering. Like I remember one conversation specifically where the girl approached me and she was like, I don't really know how to think about this, but this guy that I'm about to marry doesn't want me to be on birth control because he says that's abortion. Like, it's like, no, those are two different things. Like, nothing's wrong with abortion. That's not what I said to her at the time. But that, like, let's sit down and like go over the science of why that's not true. Mm-hmm. And let's also maybe examine like why that's not a call that he gets to make, or like whether or not that's a call that he gets to make, just to not like push her into territory that's like she's going to be completely at odds with.
Right. And that,
if that any of that makes sense. I just babbled at you a lot. I'm
no,
sorry.
That does make sense. And I think it does connect to some of your other work that you've done on purity culture. And one of the things that you write in the book, I don't know how you feel about hearing quotes back to you, but to quote your book, you say abortion stigma does not just affect abortion. It leaks into all aspects of reproductive health care and education. And that's a very succinct way of, you know, of what you've just talked about. And it does play out especially in evangelical circles through purity culture and all the things that contribute to that. So in many ways that's very much the things that connect your different aspects of your journalism, the things you've done on purity culture, as well as these things focused on abortion and reproductive justice.
Yeah, it's all connected. I mean, I see all of it as part of my beat.
And for listeners of this show, many, if not most of them, have actually been brought up in some form of conservative evangelicalism, whether it's white evangelicalism or something else. And topics like reproductive rights or reproductive justice, as well as even the history of abortion, contraception, and other types of reproductive care have been, to your point, like completely sort of obscured and overlooked, not talked about. Your book actually provides an outlook on the history of many of these practices. So what are some of those, I mean, are there some examples that you think would be worthwhile to highlight? And the way that many of these things have been practiced throughout history. You do talk and focus on sort of the professionalization of medicine as we get into the 19th and 20th centuries through to today, but whichever you think might be helpful to highlight, just given sort of the lack that folks who come from conservative evangelicalism have.
Yeah, so I think a lot of times when in that specific context of like evangelicalism, as certainly as I've experienced it anyway, like abortion was always sort of talked about as like this relatively new evil. Like the world has continued in its decline and in its wrongness, and here's abortion as like part of that. But abortion, it's important to remember, has been around for as long as humans have. People have been seeking to control their reproductive lives always, since the dawn of time. So, you know, which is important to think about when you're trying to work through like abortion as something that's very normal, right? You know, we know that at least 1 in 4 women in the United States will have an abortion in their lifetimes. That's a lot of people. So yeah, I mean, for the book, I got to look at ancient abortion practices and the ways that ancient civilizations regarded abortion. You know, it wasn't always something that people were, you know, haphazardly like, you get an abortion, you get an abortion. Like the patriarchy bled into things, certainly, and there was like regulation. But I don't think that things really took the turn that we see now until like what you were talking about with the 19th and 20th centuries with the professionalization of medicine. And that was an example of, or that was shaped by, God, I need more coffee.
In your book, you mentioned that the legislative framework doesn't enter the picture until the 19th century. Around 1821 was the first law, I believe, in Connecticut. It was a state law, and then later Comstock caused a lot of problems.
And like what we have to remember about this stuff is that like these were white men who were bringing these sorts of regulations in, right? So this wasn't coming from people who really understood what it meant to carry a pregnancy or understood the consequences of giving birth when they were not equipped to parent. So, you know, before that, abortion care had been part of midwifery, it had been part of community care. It had been practiced among enslaved women as a way of trying to grasp at as much reproductive agency as they could possibly get under those like horrific, horrific circumstances. And then like suddenly you have like this group of white men who come in and A, realize that there is economic gain to be made in medicine. And so they push out all the midwives and criminalize midwifery and community care. And B, it's another thing to control. And I think that sounds oversimplified, but it's not. I think there's something very human about wanting control, and we see that throughout history. So, you know, people want power, people crave power, and this is a way that sort of shaped the course of reproductive rights.
And that is a through line throughout the book as far as how class and race have always been an aspect of which women and people that have had access to abortion here in the United States in particular. You're right that we cannot consider, again, this is a quote, we cannot consider ways women have worked to harness their own reproductive power without exploring the ways that power has been wielded against them, particularly for Black and Brown women. This was certainly a through line both before Roe, through the period of Roe, and now today, after the downfall of Roe, after the Dobbs decision. Could you elaborate on some of the ways that those realities made this access unequal throughout American history?
Yeah, I mean, there have been massive healthcare disparities in this country for a very long time, since white people sort of came in and, you know, casually committed mass genocide and all of that good stuff. I don't mean to be so glib about that. It's just, it's horrifying, and I don't know how to talk about it with the proper amount of horror, I guess, if that makes sense.
You know, this is a really sort of broad prompt that I gave you. So I was trying to build on what I think was a spot that we were sort of talking on and segueing into whichever direction you would really like to go about how class and race, beginning, especially like when we look at the period in your book that you examine after it starts to be legislated, how those factors of both class and race affected access to abortion. Because the reality is that, yes, they try to moralize it, but whenever someone of means needs access, they find a way to get it. And that's what those disparities are, some of the things that you focus on in your book. So however you want to provide an example of that.
So after the Roe v. Wade ruling that made abortion legal in the United States, that was 1973. Not too long after that, we had the Hyde Amendment proposed in Congress. What the Hyde Amendment did was it made it illegal to use federal funding, public funding for abortion. That, of course, did not affect wealthy white women. It affected lower class folks. It affected people of color who are already disempowered and disenfranchised in this country because the United States is built on white supremacist ideals, which means that Black and Brown people in particular struggle to gain economic equality, right? So they're already in this position where they have less for a reason that doesn't make any sense at all. So when the Hyde Amendment comes in, because reproductive rights was kind of led by upper middle class white women, they didn't really take the time to take that threat seriously. They were like, oh no, like we've won Roe v. Wade. It's the law of the land. This is over. It's fine. Well, famous last words. Henry Hyde comes in, the Hyde Amendment passes. Not long after that, Rosie Jimenez dies when she cannot access abortion care. And I think that was the first really concrete example that we had of someone dying after Roe because they couldn't access care when they could have accessed it had federal funding been available for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So from that point, lawmakers have figured out that it is easiest to regulate abortion against for the people who are most vulnerable in this country, right? So when someone is trying to get an abortion in a state that has heavily regulated abortion and legislated it just like to the nth degree, there are barriers to be overcome. And the barriers add up more quickly for people who are disempowered. So think about, for example, a waiting period. A waiting period is a really common abortion regulation. What happens is you go in for your first appointment and they do the ultrasound and talk to you about abortion and all that preliminary stuff. And then the state tells you that you have to wait 24, 48, 72 hours, however long the state dictates, before you can actually have that abortion. So that means two trips to a clinic. So if we're talking about someone who doesn't live in that metropolitan area, because let's face it, there aren't really abortion providers in rural America, that means they're going to have to go back home, do whatever they need to do for childcare, whatever they did to be able to get to the first appointment to begin with, all over again, potentially lose another day's wages. All of these things add up very quickly, and they add up very quickly for the people who have the fewest resources for childcare, the lowest wages, all of that, people who don't have access to a city, who like live outside of a city. So obviously that disproportionately falls on Black and Brown folks in this country and has for decades.
And this is why we see historically the development of the types of organizations that you mentioned earlier in our conversation and within your book, such as Sister Song, who coined the term reproductive justice. Could you elaborate on some of the ways in which many of these organizations focus on those people that the state has tried to and effectively tried to restrict access to reproductive care, what up to and including abortion as well as other aspects of reproductive care for those who need
it? Yeah, absolutely. God bless abortion funds forever and ever and ever. They're doing the work and have been for so long. A lot of the grassroots funds are led by women of color, queer people of color. And you see that reflected in the book as well. And the power in that is that they're leaders coming from communities that they're serving, right? So they know how to meet their community's needs. They know that it's not just about abortion access. It's about clean water, and it's about diapers and car seats and, you know, food and a whole host of other things. And I think a really great example of this is Lori Bertram Roberts, who heads the Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund in Jackson. She, you know, during Jackson's water crisis, she's been doing a lot of organizing to make sure people get clean water. You know, so it's not always just abortion care that these folks are focused on, because they know that reproductive justice encapsulates so much more than that. They also, I mean, Indigenous Women Rising is another one that I have a lot of respect for. They serve Indigenous folks who are trying to get reproductive care. They also have a lot of really cool sex education programs. And, you know, I think the power in their work is that, like, they're coming from the same place of trauma that the people they're serving are. So they're like, it's this cultural thing that everyone can kind of come together and address as one, right? And I think that's really beautiful. Like, I, as a white woman, have no business going into a space like that and being like, I'm going to help you get an abortion. Like, I can't speak to those experiences. That doesn't make me a bad person, but I'm just not equipped for that. And it's, I think it's such a beautiful thing to be able to take care of one's community. And I think that's something actually from growing up in a church and growing up in a small town that I kind of miss, honestly. Like, that was the thing where you, like, take care of your own, and someone dies and you take them a casserole. And now I'm totally going off on a tangent, but I see that kind of, it's the same kind of care that I see reflected in abortion funds. And I think it's really beautiful.
One of the things that, on that topic of care, throughout your book, you focus on a number of different organizations prior to Roe that did assist women in need of abortions or other types of service that were stigmatized. You focus on several organizations, Jane in Chicago, and the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion and Problem Pregnancies, which was in more of the Northeast. And I think it would surprise a number of listeners, especially the clergy involvement in some of these spaces. Specific to this particular audience, what about your own sort of investigation and research into this has been surprising, given the very, you know, very anti-sex, anti-women's rights? Like, so many elements of evangelicalism are stacked against this type of being open or being frank or even offering care to those who need it. What were some things that were surprising about people that brought a faith-oriented lens to this work?
I love this question. Yeah, I think something that I have really gotten to absorb over the past decade or so of my life is that evangelicalism does not equal Christianity, does not equal, like, faith writ large, right? So I loved getting to dig into this history because it is in some ways at odds with what I grew up with, but in more ways, it's very much aligned with it. It's very aligned with the good things about religion and faith and things that still appeal to me from, like, a moral perspective. So the Clergy Consultation Service, for example, like, their whole mission was to serve people, right? It was to help people who really needed it. And that's a key tenet of Christianity, right? So they really saw themselves as, you know, stepping in and caring for the least of these, caring for people who really desperately needed that. And they saw that as a mission from God. That's really powerful to me, especially with the background that I have. And actually, I wonder how that resonated with you too.
I would say similarly. So to sort of learn about those things, because they were not things that I was aware of. I mean, I grew up like United Methodist, small town United Methodist, which tends to be more conservative than big city United Methodist. And I went to Indiana Wesleyan. I had a class on that was based on Whatever Happened to the Human Race, the co-written book from Francis Schaeffer and C. Everett Koop. And, you know, it was very much a sort of anti-choice type environment. And then it wasn't until, you know, many years later, I took a grad school course that was taught by a sociologist named Nicola Beisel, and she focused on She was actually a Comstock scholar, and then she assigned books like Abortion and the Politics of Motherhood and other books about, you know, morality, politics. And it wasn't until like articles like yours and by Jillian Frank and some other folks that really surfaced these stories. And it was encouraging to see that, like, that there was that level of sort of compassion, because that's what's lacking in the messaging you receive in a very quote pro-life environment. Like, there's no compassion.
No, it's all judgment based.
Mm-hmm. And so to see ministers involved in helping in a way that, you know, they weren't doing the procedures, but they were connecting people that needed something vital. Yeah, it's definitely challenging, you know, but also in a way, like, even if you don't participate in a faith space anymore, there's something that's encouraging about knowing that there are others who find a way for that to motivate them towards compassion.
Yeah, I also just, like, I think about all the, like, so when I was in college, I was in the crew in Campus Crusade for Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, I like to think about what it would have been like being in crew and having those meetings and having, like, the big conference every year, and what it would have been like for someone to bust up in there and be like, have you heard of the clergy consultation service for problem? Like, it would have completely blown my mind. But I think even then it would have made some amount of sense to me, in the way that reading and really researching this organization, it was just, I don't know, it was like something clicked. It was like, oh, like, this makes perfect sense, actually. Like, it makes perfect sense to serve people in this way and really meet them where they're at and really address their needs instead of just trying to pray it away, I guess. I really, yeah, I found my research into the CCS to be a lot of fun. And I mean, that's a theme that continues throughout the book. A lot of people who work in abortion rights spaces are people of faith that are doing this because they feel like it is a mission for them. They feel like God has called them to this work. And for someone like me who grew up the way that I did, like, that's completely radical and I can't get enough of it.
And do you think that informs your journalistic sort of approach to this? Because the way it comes across on the page is that you tend to the stories of people who sought abortions or needed care in some other way with a lot of compassion and tenderness, because each story, each anecdote is very affecting and individual to that person. And the thing about your book and so many others and is that knowing and hearing these stories complicates the sort of simple political and theological narratives that happen. So, like, how much does your background inform that? And does that make you sort of have hopes or desires for the way other journalists or storytellers steward these types of stories?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think so. I don't, you know, if someone asked me what my religious beliefs are, I'm not totally sure what I would tell them, frankly. I'm one of those.
It's totally fair.
They're totally, like, as I've said before, like, they're totally parts of Christianity that still really resonate with me in a mm-hmm. powerful way. And I think I do still carry a lot of that with me. I do see my work as a journalist and as a storyteller to be based in a lot of care and a lot of empathy. And I do try to really bring that to my reporting. I don't think I'm ever going to be the kind of journalist who can just, like, I don't know, do, like, the hardcore political stuff and, you know, like, nailing people to a wall or anything like that. Like, this is more my speed, like, getting to sit down with someone and being like, you know, tell me your story. I want to understand it. And that's what I got into journalism to do. And I got into journalism while I was still Christian. So I think it does still come from that place, and I do still see it as a sort of act of, I don't know, for me it's an act of love, and I hope that doesn't come off as like saviorish, because that's not the way that I think about it, but it's, I don't know, like I don't think I'd still be in it and still be doing it if it was anything less than that.
Yeah, I see. I think I see what you mean in that. I mean, much of the language that we sort of absorbed early on is about love and about calling your vocation. And mm-hmm. So I think that I follow what you're saying, which is that's what motivates you. Right? And
yeah.
There's so many different directions. And one thing that I've sort of been, you know, that I appreciated about your book is the way that it does highlight people's stories. And even though our conversation, and I think this is actually appropriate, like our conversation isn't using their stories or appropriating them. They fit within the context of the book, but they don't fit within the context of this conversation. Bearing that in mind, the one thing about this aspect of life is that there are all sorts of individual, very singular reasons why this care is needed. And now we're in a legal environment where Roe has been defeated, and there's a lot of uncertainty day to day, especially given where someone lives. And in your role as a journalist and in communication with activists, are there some reputable sources, even for information with regard to whether it's access or just the state of legalization in particular places, that you would recommend people reference? And that honestly, that like this is a podcast. It's not an abortion fund. It's not, you know, I'm not, what I'm able to do though is maybe pass on a little bit of information and some perspective. So are there different sites or places with authority that we could reference either in the show notes and in our conversation here in case someone needs to explore options?
Yes, absolutely. So just for like data and sort of the most up-to-date legal landscape, I rely pretty heavily on Guttmacher Institute. They just have like some of the best research out there. If I were an abortion seeker, I would go to a website called ineedana.com. And that sort of also helps you navigate what your options are based on where you live. Plan C pills also will help folks find options for medication abortion should they choose to self-manage, which is a safe option. And I'm trying to think what I'm missing. And then, you know, abortion funds are a great way to try and figure out, although they may be a little more limited legally in what they can and can't say based on where in the United States they are, they do a lot of really incredible work helping people access financial resources for being able to travel to get an abortion or whatever that need kind of looks like.
Well, Becca, your book is very effective and powerful at summarizing the history that led to this moment. It's very sensitive with the stories that you shepherd and include in the book, and very glad that it's out there and will be available for people to read and for it to contribute to the sort of broader conversations that books enable. Where can people find the book? Where can they find you online? Anything else you'd like to mention here?
Sure. Yeah, you can find it anywhere. You can request it at your library, which I really love because I love libraries. You can find it on bookshop.org, which supports indie bookstores, which is another really important thing to me. You can also find it on Amazon. That's totally an option. I don't judge. And then you can find me mostly on Twitter at @KBeccaAndrews, where I babble a lot, hopefully slightly more coherently than I have on this podcast. Thank you so much for bearing with me. It's been a wild ride lately.
This has been great, and I'm absolutely sure it has. I'm excited for people to hear our conversation and get a chance to pick up the book. Becca, thank you very much for joining me today.